if you have been like me over the last more than days, weeks, and years, actually, we've been glued to the geopolitics of Eastern Europe and Russia. What we're seeing on our 24-hour news channels is arms, weapons, aid being delivered from the United States. Britain has also promised support for Ukraine as what many fear is an impending invasion of Russia into the Ukraine. What does that mean for geopolitics? What does that mean for the possibility? Would there even be a possibility of all-out armed conflict, war in that part of the world? And what that means for the rest of us, particularly us in the southernmost tip of Africa. Cormac Smith is a veteran British civil servant. He's worked in the Ukraine. He has advised the British diplomats, also advised the Ukrainian state on various policy matters. He's keeping a very close eye and monitoring, and also has a deep insight in what has been not months, years, but a decades long situation since the fall of the Iron Curtain, since the end of the Cold War, since Ukraine separated itself from the Soviet Union, very, very early 90s. And what that means for us now. Joining me on the line from London, Cormac Smith. Thanks so much for joining us here on The Morning Review in Cape Town. How are you doing?
Lester, good morning. From a rather chilly London, I bet it's warmer where you are. It's 2 degrees here currently, which actually for us is kind of, I still, you know, that still keeps me in shorts and a t-shirt.
you've taken off the sweater. You've taken off the cardigan.
I don't wear a sweater. I only wear a sweater when I go out to Kiev, where it's considerably colder. Look, Lester, it's absolutely a pleasure to join you this morning. Could I comment, if I may? I mean, you started by saying, you know, what does this mean for people in South Africa? More than anything else, this is about the rule of law and the rules-based order, and it's about freedom and democracy. Now, I it's with great trepidation that I comment on South Africa, but as an outsider, I see South Africa actually as a fairly new country, or a country reborn after the downfall of apartheid, and with Mr. Mandela getting out of prison and so forth. And you know your own history very well. Clearly, South Africa is a country which has lots and lots of issues. But my observation on that is, this is not unusual for new countries. Ukraine is effectively, it is only 30 years since 92% of the population of Ukraine voted for independence from Russia and to go and to embrace the freedom that they had thirsted for hundreds of years. What Russia is now doing is moving back into that space. Russia has already invaded Ukraine 8 years ago, has occupied 7% of Ukrainian land, has killed 14,000 Ukrainians in what's been called a frozen war, has driven 2.5 million Ukrainians from their homes, and has injured tens of thousands, some horribly, with life-changing injuries. I met many veterans when I was out there. And now Putin threatens to further invade Ukraine, to take the capital city, Kyiv, and to put in place a puppet government. This is the greatest threat we've had in Europe to peace since the Second World War. We have built a rules-based order, which people in South Africa are working very, very hard towards greater democracy, greater freedom, greater accountability. It's a journey you're on, but to an extent, my country, Ireland, you know, got independence 100 years ago, right? We're still on a journey. So that, for me, is the most important thing about what's going on about Ukraine. It's right versus wrong. It's good versus evil. It's freedom against unfreedom.
So let's talk about that. And for many people who don't follow the science of geopolitics, but they watch the news and they see reports of fortification of the Ukrainian border, a Ukrainian army that has doubled in size just within, I think, the last 3 years. At the same time, on the other side, a Russian army that also has, on the other side, encamped. So we ask, what does Russia want? And what does the Ukraine not want to deliver or to give?
Okay, I'll start with what Russia wants. First is what Russia wants us to believe they want. And Russia has created a straw man that NATO is aggressive and NATO is threatening Russia. And Putin has said unless NATO withdraws that he will invade Ukraine, which of course is not a NATO member. This is what we call a straw man. This is a complete false narrative, which is what the Russians do. Russia fears one thing and one thing only, and that is a successful, independent, free Ukraine on its doorstep, because nothing else. That will be fuel to the fire of the democracy movement in Russia, which is currently put down very, very brutally and has its leaders frequently arrested, beaten up, or even murdered, or in many cases. So the revolution of dignity, the Maidan revolution in 2014 in Ukraine, which brought about the downfall of a pro-Kremlin president, Yanukovych, was a great threat. It was following this revolution that Russia invaded the east of Ukraine and illegally annexed Crimea. And that war has been rumbling on in almost First World War trench fashion for the last 8 years. And the Kremlin is now signaling that it wants to go further. But be very, very clear, what Russia wants is to choke Ukraine, is to stop Ukraine becoming the successful free country that it wants to become. It has a false narrative. It will tell the world that Ukraine is a failed state. It will tell the world that Ukraine is a fascist state. It will tell the world that the 2014 popular revolution was in fact an American-backed coup. None of that is true. What Ukraine wants is pure and simple. Ukraine wants to be left in peace. 92% of its people 30 years ago voted for independence. And since then, by almost every measure, Ukraine has moved further to the West and further away from Russia. And I, in the 2 years I spent out there, I had many, many conversations with people who had grown up in the Soviet Union and told me how much this actually meant to them. I was told it's not just that we want to be more Western, we want to get away from our horrible past ruled by Russia and the Soviet Union. So all Ukraine wants to be is to be left alone in peace. And that's not the politicians or the oligarchs. That's what the Ukrainian people want. Mm. If Russia would go away, there would be no war, there would be no threat. Ukraine is not going to invade Russia the same way as NATO is not going to invade
Russia. Well, that has been the argument of Russia. They're saying that there was assurances that NATO wouldn't expand to the east of the European subcontinent, and therefore there wouldn't be defense missile shields pointed at Russia. Russia argues that they're not defensive; they're offensive rockets. So the point is, Russia is saying, well, if Ukraine joins NATO, that then puts Russia at risk. Is there the possibility that in fact Ukraine does then join NATO? What then does that mean for the Russian sentiment and what it feels as well? NATO hasn't kept its promise of joining countries east into the European continent.
Lester, if I could address that first, it is hotly disputed that those undertakings were ever given to Russia, that there would be no further expansion, and in particular Putin is demanding that Ukraine and Georgia in particular never be allowed join. That is a non-starter. Jens Stoltenberg, who is the Secretary General of NATO, said a number of weeks ago, you know, we're not going to see Ukraine join NATO probably any day soon, but the door is open. In fact, a number of years ago, I sat in a meeting with Jens Stoltenberg and the foreign minister of Ukraine discussing this very issue. Stoltenberg has said, when the time comes for Ukraine to join NATO, that will be a decision for 30 NATO members and for Ukraine and for nobody else. This is not Russia's business. Russia claims that it has the right to have a sphere of influence. Mm. It does not. Spheres of influence died with the end of the Cold War. The only people that deserve to have a sphere of influence in Ukraine are the 43 million Ukrainian people who live there and who have voted for independence from Russia. Again, I repeat, it is a Russian. The foreign minister I worked for, Pavlo Klimkin, coined a phrase: Russia lies on an industrial scale. Russia wages hybrid war. And one of the weapons in Russia's hybrid war toolbox is lies and disinformation and false narratives. Can I give you a very, very short example? In 2018, you might remember, the Russians tried to murder a former spy called Skripal and his daughter in Salisbury on British soil. I was in Ukraine when that happened, and I started working on that with the Ukrainians. I then came back to the UK, and I worked in our national security communications team. My role was as an expert on disinformation, that I had learned a lot about in my 2 years in Ukraine, embedded with the Ukrainian government. We were very clear, the British government was very clear from our intelligence from the beginning that this was an assassination attempt carried out by the GRU, the successors to the KGB, Russian agents. Russia denied this point blank. We identified not one denial, 47 false narratives which came directly from the Kremlin. This was the British Foreign Office. One of those, I won't give you all 47. One was that Theresa May, the then Prime Minister, did it. Another was crazy. Porton Down is a chemical weapons, a chemical warfare center close by. It blew in on the wind from Porton Down. The other was the CIA did it. The list went on and on and on. You know, through channels like Russia Today and Sputnik and their troll farms, and what Russia does as part of their hybrid aggression against other countries and against the West in particular, is they lie, and they lie on an industrial scale. NATO's not a threat. Ukraine is not a threat. If Russia goes away, all threats go away, and all possibility of war goes away. And the Ukrainians get on with building their relatively new state in peace and working towards the prosperity that all of us have a right to have.
You've mentioned sphere of influence. There's been analysis that Russia feels that in terms of a Russo-ethnic culture, Ukraine is part of Russia. There's also been analysis of also being a test for the United States of how they've had to very swiftly withdraw from Afghanistan. And what that showed was a fragmented United States and its partners, talking about Germany, talking about the United Kingdom, in that swift withdrawal from Afghanistan. So this being a test to this concept of NATO unity. But is there also an economic factor here in annexing the Crimea region, access to resources, to ports? Is that also part of this conversation?
I think the economics are part of it, but I think the defense and the geopolitical domination is far more important to Russia. Look, there's a big talk now among Americans and the Brits and the other Western allies of imposing huge sanctions on Russia. And I hope that does happen if it's needed. But the truth is, Russia has built up very considerable reserves over the last 7 or 8 years. They can probably, certainly in the shorter term, they can weather the economic sanctions. This is about, I must come back on one point. You talked about the Russian claim, which Putin set out very, very clearly, I think in a 4.5 hour speech that he made back during the summer, that Russians and Ukrainians are the same people. Yeah. Well, I've got to tell you that over 40 million Ukrainian people have something to say about that, and that they are not the same people. And they have in recent years, and especially since Russia invaded Ukraine, that brotherliness and friendship and commonality that certainly existed to a far, far greater extent has broken down and been destroyed. If your friend comes into your home and wrecks your home and, you know, rapes your wife and beats up your children and steals your valuables, they are no longer your friend. You are very, very hurt, but they're no longer your friend. They become your enemy. And that's what Russia has effectively done to Ukraine. So they're not the same people. And that's not me telling you. Over 40 million Ukrainian people will tell you that. You talk about Afghanistan. And I think, this is outside my sphere. I think undoubtedly there are huge concerns about the way the US and the West and everybody else left Afghanistan, and there have been question marks over the unity of the West and so forth. I'm not really in a position to comment on that. I'm not an Afghan expert. What I do know is that was then, this is now. Britain has been leading the charge, and along with the Americans, in terms of consolidating the support behind Ukraine and the opposition to Russia. It's very, very clear in the last week in particular that other allies have been coming a lot more firm. There was a big meeting of EU heads of state only 24 hours ago, and the reports out of that were of absolute unity. The Brits were one of the first. We were one of the first to send a huge amount of weapons, anti-armor, light anti-tank weapons, to Ukraine, which they had asked for and they're hugely grateful for. Shortly after this, we saw other countries starting to provide the weapons that Ukraine has been asking for a number of months. So there's clear signals over here that the West is starting to unite and solidify behind this, because actually we realize that it will not end with Ukraine. It will be other countries, and it will be, you know, Putin also seeks to destabilize other countries, you know, interference in elections or cyber attacks or assassinations on our soil, whatever. Mm. And there's been more and more clarity that actually, one, this is about rule of law and the right of, you know, the absolute right. I've got a friend called Katerina in Kiev, and Katerina in Kiev has every bit as much right to live in freedom as, let's say, Donna in Durban, you know, or Linda in London, or Derville in Dublin. It's that fundamental.
We're running out of time, Cornbread, and we've not seen a multi-nation conflict war since 1945. It's largely been proxy wars around the world with two then Cold War powers. And on our television screens right now, if I flip through, whether it be BBC, Al Jazeera, Sky or CNN in front of me, I see the reports of aid and military armaments being bolted on, whether it be by NATO, the United States, or whether it be by Russia. The concept of global conflict decades in our memory. What is the likelihood of the first shot being, first rocket being launched, first mortar being launched, and then escalating into what would then be multinational war for the first time since 1945?
The possibility is really, from a European point of view, the possibility is too horrific to even contemplate. Certainly, we are starting to think that that is a greater possibility now, probably, than it has been any time since 1945 and the end of the Second World War. I don't think we're there yet. I think we are still going to see a, you know, at the very worst, a invasion which is contained, which is largely contained to Ukraine, but it's very difficult. The Americans and the Brits, for example, are reinforcing NATO forces in countries now that border the Russia. I was almost going to say Soviet Union, but it's Soviet Union 2.0, as a number of people have called it, because indeed what Putin wants to do is he wants to put the band back together. He wants to put the Russian Empire back together, which is what the USSR effectively was. So that's that is certainly a concern. I'm not a defense analyst. I mean, it's not, I don't think it's helpful if I give an opinion. Oh, I think this is definitely going to happen. I sincerely hope that it won't. But what I can say, listening to all the voices around Europe and in the UK, it's a greater concern. There's more concern over the possibility of a pan-European conflict, certainly than there was, than there has been since the horrible Balkans conflict in the 90s, and before that, as I say, right back to the Second World War. This clearly has the potential, I would say, to spiral out of control.
Cormac Smithy, analyst, giving us what is for many of us a primer on what is currently happening in geopolitics.